Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us for Messages from the Midrash. I want to dedicate our shiur tonight, L'ilui Nishmas, Tzvi Yosef Herschel. I don't see a Ben, but it's Beverly Brandler's father, and Rebbetzin Grumblatt's brother. Again, we probably have that somewhere. Rebbetzin Grumblatt's brother, who is also a rabbi. His yard site was today, as well as Yaakov ben Avraham Alevi, Lieberman's father. And that's what I have here. So our learning should be Leilui Nishmatam. Great to be with everyone for Parshat Bo. Open myself to the right page. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about the Makkah of Choshech, the plague of darkness. And then we'll talk a little bit about Moshe and Aharon receiving the first mitzvah in the Torah briefly. And then we'll talk about the beginning of the Exodus, the beginning of Israel leaving Mitzrayim. So Makkah of Choshech is kind of an interesting one. It's in some ways the least destructive of the Makot. The Torah says, "V'yomer Hashem Moshe, netei yadcha al Hashemayim v'choshech al eretz Mitzrayim v'yamish choshech." So Hashem said to Moshe, "Stretch out your hand towards heaven." This translation, as you can tell, was written quite a number of decades ago, so I have to think on the spot to translate it into modern English. "Stretch out your hand toward the heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, and even darkness which may be felt." Right? It was so thick that you could feel the darkness. So the Midrash says, "Zeh she'amar ha'katuv, shalach choshech v'yechshich v'lo maru et dvaro." This is in Psalm 105. He sent darkness, and it was dark. And then this next part is hard to. It's discussed in the Midrash how to translate this, but it would literally translate as "and they rebelled against his word." But to understand this word "maru," that they rebelled, so we have to understand who the they is. Who's the they? So Choshe Sharach HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ala Mitzrim Kasha Haya. At first glance, it would seem like we're talking about the Egyptians, but you can't say the Egyptians didn't rebel. They did rebel. They weren't God-fearing people. But it says that the darkness that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, so it was very thick. So lama, Ashalo kibul marit dvaro shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that they didn't accept the authority of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So mar can mean master or authority. So when it says velo marit dvaro, so it doesn't mean that they didn't rebel, but it means really the opposite, that they didn't accept the authority of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Brit Tzadik, Rav Tzadik of Lublin, asked the question, so what was it that the Mitzrim did? So the problem is, so in theory, one could argue that that was Paro who was the wicked one. Average Egyptian, maybe not so much. But there's a couple of things worth noting. Number one, there are midrashim that indicate that actually originally Paro was not interested in enslaving Bnei Israel, that when it says that Paro didn't know Yosef, well, he originally did know Yosef. He recognized what Yosef did, but it was the Egyptians who, the Gemara says, overthrew Paro until he was willing to enslave Bnei Israel and to deal with them harshly. So in some ways, one could say that maybe it was the responsibility of the Mitzrim. But even if not, so at this point, we're up to the eighth plague. So truth is, the first number of plagues affected the Egyptians also. But if we want to talk about that this plague specifically came as a result of the Egyptians not accepting Hashem's authority. So the point is that they didn't accept Ol Malchut Shamayim. They didn't accept the yoke of heaven in the first eight plagues. So here we are. Now, Rav Tzadok says that there was, he talks about a pasuk from Micha that says, Hashem Or Li, that Hashem is light for me. So light can represent a lot of things. It represents Torah. But in this pasuk, it says that Hashem represents light. So if they're not accepting Hashem, so what is the logical darkness of that? Logical opposite of that? The answer is darkness. That the plague of darkness corresponds with the notion of them not accepting Hashem, who's represented by light. Right? So they were. So that was the darkness. But Midrash gives another alternative understanding. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu LaMalachim Hamitzrim Briyun Liel Kol Bachosha. The Egyptians should be smitten with darkness. So they immediately agreed, and they didn't rebel. And the elucidation of the Medrash that I have suggests that it was both Malachi Din and Malachi Rachim, that even the angels who would have normally been pro-mercy understood that that they deserve this this makkah. So when it says Lomar, it's referring to the Egyptians not the Egyptians, it's referring to the angels who didn't rebel. There's a couple places in the Torah where we see an indication that perhaps Hashem consults with the Malachim. For example, in creation, it says Nasadam Betzalmenu Kidmutenu. So that's referring to Hashem consulting with the angels. So it is interesting that this notion of Hashem consulting, but nonetheless, he does it. Thinking today in a different context of, I don't know why this came to my mind, but the story goes that when Rav Aaron Lichtenstein would give a shir kali, which used to be every other week, so in yeshivas, they often have a shir kali that's given by the Rosh Yeshiva. So even if everybody has sort of their own class that they go to, each teacher has a different style, but then the Rosh Yeshiva gives like a general lecture to the whole yeshiva. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein would switch off with Rav Yehuda Amital that responsibility from week to week. So Rav Lichtenstein would go over to each of the Rebbeim and say, "Do you mind if I talk about X next topic?" Which is you know, like every Rebbe is like, "Why are you asking me? Talk about whatever you want. We're not going to tell the Rosh Yeshiva to not speak about a particular topic." But there's this model of even somebody who has perhaps the right to make unilateral decisions, that nonetheless it's good to consult others. The Chasam Sofer gives another possibility, that it's Bnei Yisrael that didn't rebel. In what sense? That it's Choshech, it's complete darkness. So in theory, it's possible Bnei Yisrael could have just gotten up and left. Why didn't they leave in the Makom Choshech? They could have been all over. They 3-day darkness. Pick up everything, get out of there. Nobody would know, and then by the time that the light comes back, all of a sudden everyone's gone. So why didn't they leave during Makom Choshech? So the Chasam Sofer explains that that there was a shvua, that there was an oath that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had put them under to not leave until Paro gives them permission. So why that is, I'm not entirely sure, but I do think it's one thing to take away from that is that when it comes to midot, so sometimes it's not just about the way we treat other people and the effect that our actions have on somebody else, but it's about sort of what mark it makes on us. We make that particular decision. So if we're if we made a shvua that to not do something, so the idea is that leaving stealthily perhaps is not a good thing, to do things in a stealthy way. So even if you have the right to do it, and even though you're entitled to do it, and what does the other side care? But perhaps it's not, perhaps it's not a good mark on that person. But even then, maybe that's a midas chasidus. Maybe that's going above and beyond. But here they have a shvua. Here they have to listen to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. In general, we're mushpa v'yom and mehar Sinai, that we have an oath from Har Sinai to follow the Torah. So perhaps even when things are in our better interest, or we think are better in our better interest, we still can't go against what Hashem says. Whatever Hashem says, go, because we have an ongoing shvua from Har Sinai not to do anything he doesn't say. Then the Midrash continues. Shalach choshech v'yachshich. So that's from that pasuk in Tehillim, that Hashem sent darkness, and it was dark. That this darkness had a substance of its own, as we said. So mashal lamahadavar dumna. So what is this similar to? Perhaps it's compared to a king who had a slave who rebelled against him. A little bit ironic here. Amar la'achad, lech v'hakeil 50 maglevim. So he told one of his aides, go give him 50 lashes. Alach v'ikahu mea. And then he goes and does 100. So P.S., by the way, that when from a Torah legal perspective, you're only allowed to, you'd have to assess, in order to give mankos, you have to assess how many lashes a person could withstand. And if you give one extra that beyond what you were allowed to, that kills it. So the Beis Din is responsible. So generally speaking, from a Torah perspective, you're actually not allowed to add to Makos. But in this parable, so the king tells the aide to give 50 lashes, and he gives 100 lashes. He adds on his own. So Kodesh Baruch Hu made it dark for the Egyptians, and he tells them choshech mishalo, and the darkness increased on its own. So why does it repeat? He sent darkness and then it was dark. The idea was that the darkness added and multiplied on its own, which is perhaps an interesting perspective when we think back to what was it that Rambam talks about, what was it that Paro did wrong, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham Avinu that we were going to be enslaved. So Kadosh Baruch Hu, so Paro did exactly what he was told to do. He enslaved the Bnei Israel. Why should he be punished for that? Same thing with Nebuchadnezzar destroying the Beis Hamikdash. Well, that's what Hashem's will was. The answer is that when one goes beyond what Hashem, in both those cases, they went beyond in terms of the damage they did. They went far beyond what Hashem had envisioned or stipulated. So that irony kind of comes back here, that the darkness increases on its own, that maybe in theory they only deserve a certain amount of darkness, but Mita connected Mita, because they added on to the enslavement beyond what they should have, so Kadosh Baruch Hu had it so that the darkness would increase on its own. Rav Tzadok goes on to say also, Rav Tzadok said that Hashem Orli, that the Egyptians got the plague of darkness because they didn't accept Hashem represented by light. They didn't accept his authority. So that's the Hosef Mishalo. The reason why the darkness was added on from its own is because it represents a lack of accepting Hashem's authority, divinity, not accepting that Hashem controls the world. So the more they became entrenched in that, the greater the darkness increases. Okay, I'm going to go on to Simon. Hey, I think I'm only going to do a little part of it. You should try to do a whole medrash. This one isn't so long, but it kind of moves on to a different subject in the middle. And the last one is one that I'm particularly interested in doing. So this is the beginning of chapter 12. In chapter 12, we get the first mitzvah that's given to Bnei Yisrael, Chodesh Hazeh Lachem. Rashi famously says that the Torah in theory should have started from this parak, because that's when we begin to have mitzvot, notwithstanding the three that appear in Bereishit, but this is when mitzvot are really given directly to explicitly to Bnei Israel. And so this is where we learn about the cycle, the lunar cycle, the months, and the like. Yeah, and the instructions for the Korban Pesach, because Korban Pesach and setting dates for the holidays is contingent upon setting Rosh Chodesh properly. So Pesach begins by Hashem Moshe ve'el Ha'aron be'eretz Yitzrayim limor. Hashem spoke to Moshe and to Aharon in the land of Egypt. By the way, before I go any further, so some editions of Midrashim say that they have this note that this is from Mechilta de Rabbi Shmuel. This is from Mechilta de Rabbi Shmuel. So Mechilta de Rabbi Shmuel is technically halachic midrash. It also includes agada, includes sort of non-legal aspects also. So apparently from, as far as the Tanchuma goes, so a lot of Tanchuma from here till the end of Parshat B'Shalach overlaps with this Bechilta de Rabbi Shmuel. Not that one is directly copied from the other, but and many midrashim that there's overlap. There's also overlap between Tanhuma and the Medrash Rabbah, and all of them. So, but a lot of these are from Bechilta. In fact, when you go on to some of the later midrashim in Parshat Bo, it's actually kind of hard to pick some of these because they get very sort of technical in darshaning the psukim and sort of learning halachic principles from the psukim. It's worthwhile Torah, but albeit a little bit sort of drier and direct. But you get that as I before I kind of picked up on this whole that this was in fact correlated with Mechilta. I look at some of these later midrashim and say, wow, this is a different style. So Hashem says to Moshe and Aharon, "V'chilo yadibor elo Moshe bilvad." What? Hashem only spoke to Moshe alone. So why does it say Moshe and Aharon? So Kshem Sheya Moshe kol dibro kach Aharon. Moshe and Aharon, in fact, were both included. They were both included. U'minan shelo dibar im Aharon. So sounds like Moshe and Aharon are included. So why is Midrash saying that Hashem didn't speak to Aharon? D'chtiv v'hi b'yom dibar Hashem Moshe b'er Mitzrayim. It's a pasuk that says that Hashem spoke to Moshe in Eretz Mitzrayim. L'Moshe v'lo l'Aharon. At that time, it was to Moshe, not to Aharon. Avkan l'Moshe v'lo l'Aharon. Here too, it's just to Moshe and not to Aharon. M'nei ma lo dibar im Aharon. So why didn't Hashem speak with Aharon? B'shvil kvodo shel Moshe. For the sake of the honor of Moshe. We're not supposed to go after kavod, but the Torah is still concerned with proper kavod. There's there are places where we're definitely supposed to give kavod. We're just not supposed to run after it. Same came nitzeta memai kavod Aharon. But if that's the case, so you're by increasing the kavod of Moshe, you're decreasing the kavod of Aharon, right? Lo shishneim shavim. No, they're still equal. V'chein atam otzei kol makom shishneim b'makom echad. Every place where you have Moshe and Aharon mentioned together, Shnem Shavim. They're both mentioned together. So, a couple examples. B'yom Atzot Hashem Elokim Eretz v'Shamayim. On the day that Hashem created Eretz and Shamayim, so the land and the heavens are equal. Kaber Davicha v'Dimecha. So, it's interesting that the Gemara wants to try to understand what in Shmot, in the Aseret HaDibrot, so the father comes before the mother. In Parsha Kedoshim, the mother comes before the father. So the Gemara does a whole understanding of that. But the question might come up, well, maybe is somebody supposed to honor their father more than their mother? The answer is really no. The reason why a father comes first is that it's easier to respect the mother because you fear her less, right? So we have to emphasize the kavod of the father. But putting that aside, father and mother are really equal in kavod. And Yeshua and Kalev are mentioned together. That means that they're equals. I'm learning this Perek in Bamidbar. I'm learning with my seventh graders right now. We were talking about the fact that when it comes to Kalev, the Torah specifically singles out that Kalev is going to go to Eretz Yisrael without mentioning Yehoshua at first, which is a fascinating thing. So this whole discussion about why Kalev is singled out there, but Kalev and Yeshua are equal. Same, so too, Moshe and Aharon are equal. It's actually not the first place where this comes up. There's in Parshat Va'era, in two psukim apart, it says who Aharon and Moshe, and then it says who Moshe and Aharon. So it's interesting that it mentions both Aharon and Moshe, but it flips it. So Rashi explains Yesh Bekom Shemakim Aharon and Moshe, Yesh Bekom Shemakim Moshe and Aharon. So sometimes Aaron comes first, sometimes Moshe comes first. Lomar chashish gulin ke'echa, that they're equal. And in fact, apparently this is based on Mechilta. Again, even though our Medrash here seems to be similar to the Mechilta, it's not quite the same. But we got this idea that Moshe and Aharon are equal. And in fact, at the end of Parsha Shmot, when it talks about Aharon going out to greet Moshe, well, it doesn't really say about the pasuk here in the end of Perek Dalet of Shmot. It says Vayishak Lo that he kissed him, so it doesn't say who kissed who. So the Midrash goes on in Tanchuma. The Midrash says that that Moshe Aharon meant. So again, it's this idea that that they're sort of equal. And the Midrash there talks about how at that moment Tzedek and Shalom met and kissed, so to speak. Chesed and Emet met and kissed. And something you get from that is the fact that Moshe and Aharon are equal, but they're complementary. They're not the same. They're not the same, but their different attributes and the different strengths balance out each other. That you need both tzedek and shalom. You need, on the one hand, you need justice, but you also need peace. You need chesed, you need kindness, but you also need emet, truth. So sometimes they conflict, but they're both complementary. And Moshe and Aharon, as a pair, were able to embody both of those in a fantastic way. And that, and the context of course, this idea of Moshe Aharon being equal also comes up in when it comes to Parshat Vayera. So it's talking about the fact that Aharon was going to speak for Moshe. So Moshe had certain unique attributes at the end of the day make him Moshe, but he needs Aharon. He needs Aharon in order to be able to carry out his tasks. So Moshe and Aharon complement each other. We're still sort of left with this idea that even though Moshe and Aharon are equal, at the end of the day, Hashem still spoke to Moshe. We haven't really quite answered that question. So in some ways, maybe it's sort of left there that for whatever reason, Moshe was a greater Navi than anybody who ever walked the face of the earth. So then Moshe sort of does have that that greater elevated status, but it's not necessary to detract from the role that Aharon played and the complementary role that he played. The rest of the Midrash is interesting, but I want to end with Simon Chet. So this is talking about Israel leaving Mitzrayim. That the people took their dough before it was leavened upon their shoulders, and it did not rise. Who ceases to stir from the kneading of the dough until it's leavened. So their kneading troughs alludes to leftover unleavened bread and bitter herbs. So you may interpret it that it's talking about leftover matzah mara. Maybe it's talking about the Korban Pesach. So you're not allowed to leave over Korban Pesach, but Matzah Maror could be left over. So Al Shechman. So what does that mean when it talks about that they, again, this is the style of the Midrash here, the Mechilta style, that's just sort of goes through every word and wants to understand exactly what's being referred to here. So they carried it on their shoulders. Why didn't they put everything on their animals' backs? Why did people have to carry it themselves? They had lots of animals. They had lots of flock to carry their load. So why did they do it themselves? They loved mitzvahs. And the Sfat Emet explains that not only do they love mitzvah, but this is the very first mitzvah, the first opportunity. I remember the first time I got homework, or one of the first times I got homework, I was like really excited, like, wow, homework, I'm an adult. Okay. So later on in life, I didn't appreciate homework that much. As students right now who are putting on fill-in for the first time, the way cutoffs work around here, I guess it's middle seventh grade that a lot of students become bar mitzvah. And you can see that there's like a little bit of like that first time the kid's putting on tefillin, that's like a very exciting thing. So the first time you do a mitzvah is especially exciting. And also this happiness to be Avdei Hashem, right? They've been Avdei Paro. And they understood that the purpose of leaving Egypt was to be servants of Hashem. So that's also, it contributes to the happiness. So they carried the matzah on their backs because it was that pride that they had in doing the mitzvah of Hashem. And then the Midrash goes on, Uvnei Yisrael asu kidvar Moshe yishalum mitzvay klechazuv klezahav usmalo. So Bnei Yisrael did what Moshe instructed, and they borrowed silver vessels or jewels and gold, and clothing. So what's with the clothing? So clothing was more beloved for them than, more precious to them than silver and gold, which is kind of an interesting interesting thing. So the Rabbi Pinchas Mikoretz, I don't know who he was, but he says that when I ask a question, well, Bnei Israel weren't supposed to dress like Egyptians. So how are they borrowing their clothing? The answer is that he says is that the Egyptians actually dressed like Bnei Israel, which is kind of a fascinating thing. But that's how they're able to do that. But I think perhaps it's interesting. So why is it that clothing would be precious? Anything, I think money is precious, but still perhaps.
Yeah. Clothes make the man.
Well, clothes make the man. And, you know, I don't know what they wore to work, so to speak. And again, if they wore specifically Jewish clothing, you know, okay, so maybe they kept, maybe there were certain articles of clothing that were particularly Jewish. But perhaps the idea is that they didn't, you know, they weren't wearing working clothing, but they were wearing much more dignified clothing. And that sort of that clothing is the expression of who they were as free people. So, okay, so having money is nice. That's a nice part of being free also, is having your own money. But the ability to wear one's freedom perhaps was particularly exciting. V'ashem natan etchein ha'am, adayin enan sholim v'hein onilat. So Hashem gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and Midrash explains that that they, even without asking, it was the Egyptians gave to them. So one suggestion of the significance here is that it's because they didn't ask that they were given, and the fact that they weren't so concerned with money is why they benefit from it, which is important. Dare we say again that when somebody who goes after kavod, the kavod runs away from them. Those who don't run towards the kavod, it comes to them. So perhaps same thing here. But I saw another interesting idea that that the Am were the people who didn't ask for the money. So those who were rich among Bnei Israel, so they wanted to retain their status. They asked for money, and they got, okay, fine. Hashem said that they were going to exit rich. That's fine. But it's also meant to emphasize that the average person, even though they weren't rich before, so they also were given a boost of kavod here. That all Bnei Israel, and I talk about that when it comes to the mitzvah of reclining on Pesach. And so the Mishnah says that even a poor person must recline. So why would I think a poor person doesn't have to recline? Because normally year round, person who's destitute may not see themselves as being anything worthy of royalty. On Pesach, even the Hamon Am were royal. Midrash ends with Natzlu Mitzrayim, Mafil Avodazar Shel Kesef Shel Zav, and Tekach Lechazar Kvadchil V'Natlu Takol. So even idols of silver and gold, they melted them down and convert them to their original state, so that it wasn't avodah zarah. Bizat hayam dolad mi bizat mitzrayim. The plunder of the sea, however, was greater than the plunder of Egypt. So that's a discussion for another time. But this gives us a little bit of perspective of some of the feelings of A, excitement of serving Hashem as they were leaving Egypt, B, sort of that free status that they assumed, and even the average person, even person who was below average in their socioeconomic status, was given an opportunity to feel like a rich, free person as they left Egypt. All right, thanks everyone for joining. Have a wonderful rest of the week.
Thank you. Have a good week.